ask was to raise salvage funds that could be run in their profit-making thrift store. Product sales are another area where we see misrepresentation in the sale of product for a charity. And of course, I guess the general public feels, well, the reason I'm not getting fair value on this is I'm helping the charity. And that may not be so. We see coupon book sales, light bulb sales, garbage bags rather, and entertainment like circuses and the like. Again, we feel this should be truthfully promoted so that people can make up their mind whether or not they want to buy these things. Fraud, we've also seen. You know, it's even come down to a very, very hardcore area where some of these telephone rooms will sell like educational programs in the school, drug books, which sounds very good, and it does raise money to educate the kids about drug abuse. The only problem that they don't tell anybody is that they don't have approval for the school system for the use of the book. And so the books never do get into the school system. And in fact, all that you have is a fundraising effort and no benefit. We've seen tickets sold to senior citizens' picnics where the senior citizens' picnics never take place and the fundraiser is long gone. A few years ago, there was a Christmas basket appeal where they said the Christmas baskets would be delivered through St. Vincent de Paul and food would go to fish. Neither organization authorized that appeal. Again, these are severe problems within the fundraising sector. False information, I think, is very, very difficult to counter, and I think that this law will do something to change that. The section on disclosure is very important. You can have an organization that gets 80% of the gross, a charitable organization, by contract. But if the promoter tells everybody, well, the charity's getting 80% of the gross, that's not truthful if he has to pay all the expenses and the net is a lot less than that. I think that's really an abuse that has to be stopped. Disadvantaged kids, that's another one of these heartrending things. It takes a lot of money from business. A lot of our businesses have bought a lot of tickets for different events to entertain disadvantaged kids. I had a long chat a few years ago with Ross Miller at the Perry Center, a very, very reputable charitable organization in the Portland area. Ross was really concerned about this aspect of business paying for tickets that are generally, in his view, not used. At one time, Ross told me that he received enough tickets to an event to take every institutionalized child in the entire state to the event, and he didn't take any of his. And so I think it's very important that we take a look at these things and make sure that they can be stopped. I intended to stop here, but I heard some things about user fees and I think that one of the things that you ought to look at is one of the philosophies that I think we've seen all along. If people that don't cause any harm are looking for such a low price that they don't pay the bill to get the people that are hurting them, then you have a problem. And I think what you really ought to think about it as is as a benefit fee. Because those people that are eliminated from the marketplace because they're unscrupulous, that elimination will benefit the legitimate charity. There's no doubt about it. And I think it should be more looked at as a benefit fee. One other thing I heard was religious aspect, and I think that certainly freedom of religion is very solidly pronounced in the Constitution. I'm concerned a little bit about one aspect or solicitation that we're seeing. We're seeing some solicitation for causes that go beyond religious benefit. You know, like, for example, you could, and I'm going to pull this one out of the air and make it up. Let's say you have the Church of the Immaculate Bingo, and they decide to run full-page ads for helping the hungry in Africa. Well, I think that appeal should bring about some kind of responsibility or reporting back to the general public from which they're soliciting that the hungry are actually being fed and what the disbursement of funds actually is, because that goes beyond just religion at that point. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony. Do you have any questions for me?
Questions from the committee members? Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
And testifying. As is our tradition, we are going to take a 7-minute break this afternoon, and then we will come back and do a work session on the three bills and then finish the hearings. And I encourage members that this is Friday afternoon and hope they will attend to the 7-minute. Session on his bill, then go to your bill. But Representative Mason is going to take less than 5 minutes.
On which bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Mason, State Representative.
2314.
2314. This is a small bill that's been here before.
Time out.
It increases the membership of the.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Springer.
I'm sorry. I just want to mention this was tabled, and I think.
Mr. Chairman, I would remove from the table.
Representative Bellamy moves to remove House Bill 2314 from the table. Clerk will call the roll. Oh, wait a minute.
When does it take? Four.
You're okay. Each member has great power.
Wait, time out.
You got
four.
And you got
clerk four. Will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Fine.
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Katsky? Aye.
Okay. The purpose of this bill is to expand the commission and the judicial branch by two. I think that it's pretty common knowledge that what we essentially want to do is to keep two of our outstanding members. Due to the retirement of Representative Myers and the retirement of Judge Beatty, those people are, by the circumstances of the statute, ineligible under the present statute. The expansion of this bill would make them eligible if they are appointed to serve on the commission. They've been the mainstays of the commission. I would also bring up for the committee's possible consideration, and this is not part of the bill, but for possible consideration, you might want to look at expanding the number of legislative members on either side from 3 to 4, or from whatever you want. We have found that legislative participation in the commission, the judicial branch, has helped immensely in getting commission proposals through. I do not think it would have a fiscal impact. And the reason I say that is that we have one of our district court judges has left the commission, Judge Davis from Medford, and I think the next district court judge to come on will probably be from the metropolitan area, which saves us an immense amount of travel expense. And so I don't think there would be a lot to it. It's been the guts of the bill is the expansion of the commission as far as the attorney and the senior judge are concerned. I would ask your indulgence, especially ask your indulgence, Representative Peterson, also ask your indulgence for House Bill 2314 to expand the commission on the judicial branch. Maybe we can take these two people and run them up the boat ramp in Jackson County.
We'll discuss this, I'm sure.
In joke.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bond.
I was an original supporter of this bill and continue to be, but I have a procedural question.
Yes.
As I recall, this went from our committee to full committee and was tabled in full committee.
Counsel, do you recall?
I can go through the last 2 minutes if you'd like.
Well, just a question. If it was tabled in full committee, how can we get it back without the full committee taking off the table up there?
My recollection is that it came back to subcommittee, but I may be in error.
I believe what happened is on February 27th, the full committee voted the bill out of the full committee to Ways and Means, and then the following week, upon reconsideration on whether or not to send, have the subsequent referral to Ways and Means rescinded, Representative Bellamy moved to table the bill, was non-debatable, and the motion to table the bill passed in the full committee.
Okay, I would prefer then that we have another motion to take this bill off the table at this point.
Well, I want to see the bill pass, and I want to aid Representative Mason, but I want to do it in a way that I feel is appropriate, and I just want to ask procedurally, and I really don't want to foul this up. If the bill's in full committee, don't we have to get it back from full committee by full committee taking action?
I see your question. I think that the chair of the full committee has
power.
Yes.
Dick, can you pull a bill that's tabled on the table as chairman and send it back here?
I think we can, even if a bill has been tabled, whether by rule or by action of the full committee, since the full committee has to take action on any bill that would come out, it would be my interpretation that to reschedule a bill to be taken from the table, it's within the chair's discretion to reschedule that before a subcommittee, and then in subcommittee, take the measure from the table by the votes necessary to do so in subcommittee, and then start the bill anew through the process, which it must go through full committee. I don't think we've had that exact question raised before. I'd be glad to chat with the chief clerk about that. I'm trying to recall, Representative Mason.
You just might want to take it off, take it off the table in the full committee to cover yourself.
That would be fine.
Then you've done it. You've taken it off the table both places prior to your vote in full committee.
Well, just a question, and I might direct this to Tom. If we just recommend, if we viewed this bill, indicated that there was a majority support in this committee recommending the full committee take it off the table, would that meet your needs?
Certainly.
Sure.
I would prefer we do it that way so that procedurally.
I don't have any problems with that, and that'll give us an opportunity to check with the chief clerk, see if she has any feeling about the procedure I just described. So, yeah, I'm comfortable with that, for one.
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we recommend to the full committee that House Bill 2314 be removed from the table and passed.
Are there any other further amendments to the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I think procedurally we should wait to amend it to full committee.
Okay.
I think technically the bill is in the hands of the full committee, even though we can decide what action is going to be taken. If somebody wanted to object, I think technically, and the amendments are going to be easy. And part of it, the other question I've got to ask is that the bill was amended in full committee. So are we dealing when we took it off the
table?
Was
it amended?
Yes, it was amended with some language about experience and business community.
Well, I'm sorry. Since we had that amendment and adopted it, my recommendation would be including the amendment.
Yeah. Well, yes, I think the bill is amended. That's been tabled, so we don't need to. I was curious about additional amendments, either in terms of members from the legislature. Let me just deal with the first motion, I'm sorry. Representative Bunn has moved to recommend to the full committee that House Bill 2314 be removed from the table and passed out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is that your motion?
That would be my motion.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to apologize to Representative Mason for missing his comments. Might I ask Representative Mason what your comments were in terms of bringing this up?
Yes, we have two very important members of the Commission on the Judicial Branch, now Senior Judge Judge Beatty and former Speaker Hardy Myers. Now that Hardy Myers is not in the legislature, he does not fill one of the commission slots. In fact, Representative Springer now fills that slot. Judge Beatty is not an acting judge and doesn't fit the criteria for a sitting judge. Those two gentlemen have been major forces in court reform in this state and are very essential to the functioning of the commission. They carry with them an awful lot of knowledge, prestige, and energy. And it's my desire to have them on the commission. If you expand the commission for both the lawyer side and the non-lawyer side, you would make those slots available for them. Now, of course, the governor has to make those appointments, but we have been fairly assured, or I'm fairly assured, that the governor would see fit to make those appointments. The history goes way back, even prior to my tenure here. I don't know if Representative Bunn was involved in the original efforts at court consolidation and court takeover. Might have been 77, 75. But it was back then when Representative Myers, then Representative Myers, started that process that the kind of seeds were sown that we are still harvesting or reaping today. And we want to keep those two gentlemen involved. It's especially Judge Beatty. I don't think Judge Beatty has been that much of a participant here, but Judge Beatty was the lobbyist for the Judicial Council for five or six sessions. And it's pretty much synonymous with court reform. And now that he's a senior judge, he doesn't fit in the in this particular slot.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I was one of the individuals when this came through the first time that voted to table it. I'm going to vote for Representative Bunn's motion today, hoping in between the time it leaves this committee and goes to the full committee that I will have a chance to work out my concerns discussed with some other people.
Further discussion on the motion. Council.
Can I ask for a clarification on the recommendation? Recommendation to the full committee to take from the table and pass out of the full committee to the floor or to Ways and Means? Do we want to try to rescind the Ways and Means subsequent
reform? In this particular case, I don't think it really matters in the sense that the Commission on the Judicial Branch budget is in Ways and Means. It'd be best not to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but it's not a fatal
to
flaw.
The floor with due pass.
Yeah, floor with the due pass.
Yes.
Does it have a subsequent referral right now to rescind? Okay.
Yes. Further discussion. I just want to explain my vote. I'm not voting for this, or originally did I vote for this to allow two individuals to be on the commission. I think there is a need to have a senior judge represented on the commission, and also to expand. I think there is a need to expand the membership of the commission. Clerk will call the roll.
Delaney?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Katsky?
Aye. Ms. Reynolds. I'm sorry.
Now
it's
better.
Now we are holding a 5-minute hearing on House Bill 2218. Ms. Reynolds.
Mr. Chairman, I promise mine would take less than 5 minutes unless there were questions. If the committee has questions, I'd be happy to answer those if I can. My name is Mike Reynolds. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice for House Bill 2218. I have a couple of pages of testimony that will summarize, I think, the testimony that's in written form that's a little bit more complete that's being handed out to you right now.
House Bill 2218 is proposed by the Department of Justice to deal with two problems in the appellate courts. The first has to do with payment of costs when a state agency is a co-respondent on appeal and the petitioner has prevailed. By statute, the petitioner is entitled to recover costs when he or she prevails on appeal. If there are two or more respondents, no provision is made by statute as to which respondent is to pay the costs. The practice of the Department of Justice has been to pay the costs and then seek contribution from the co-respondent. We do this by letter to the co-respondent. If the co-respondent does not voluntarily contribute its share of the costs, no further action is taken because the amount involved is so small that further action is not cost effective. Section 1 of House Bill 2218 simply provides that when the court awards costs, it is to apportion the costs equally among respondents who appear in the proceedings before the Court of Appeals. This way, the Department of Justice will only be required to pay its share of the costs and will not be forced to have to pay all the costs and then seek contribution from any co-respondent or respondents. We estimate that the fiscal impact of this bill would be to represent a savings of approximately $10,000 per biennium. As you can tell from the fiscal impact, it is very seldom, I guess you might say, that we actually recover the costs on a voluntary contribution basis from any co-respondents. And yet, under the statute and by law, they're just as legally liable to pay those costs as the Department of Justice is. The second problem addressed by House Bill 2218 concerns specifically appeals from Employment Division tax deficiency assessments. If you'll bear with me for a minute, I'll try to give you a capsule summary of what this process involves. Employers typically challenge tax deficiency assessments made by the Employment Division on the basis that the assessment includes compensation paid to persons whom the employer believes are not employees, that is, they're independent contractors or something else. And employment under the statute is defined such that under our 657.040, persons who receive remuneration from an employer for services performed for the employer are deemed to be subject to the covered employment unless the employer can prove both that the employer is free from the employer's direction and control and that the employee is customarily engaged in an independently established business. The employer has to prove both of those elements in order to bring the remuneration paid to that particular individual out from underneath the statute. Frequently, Employment Division referees will agree with an employer on one of these two bases, that is, that a worker is free from direction and control, for example, but will not agree that the employee is an independently established business. Because the employer has lost, not having proven both requirements of the statute, the employer will appeal to the Court of Appeals and argue that the referee erred in his conclusion that the worker was not an independently established business. In defending the referee's conclusion that the employee's wages should be included in the assessment, we may disagree with the referee's conclusion that the worker was free from direction and control. In other words, we may want to argue to the Court of Appeals that even if the referee was wrong, that the employee was not an independently established business, the employment is still covered because the worker was subject to the employer's direction and control. In other words, this is the right for the wrong reason argument that we would want to make in the Court of Appeals. Section 2 of House Bill 2218 enables the Department of Justice to make this argument without having to file a cross petition for judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. Although we don't believe we should have to file a cross petition, since we do not disagree with the determination by the referee that the employment is subject employment within the meaning of the statute, still the Court of Appeals has hinted during our oral argument on a couple of occasions that for us to make this argument to be in the court, we would have to in fact file a cross petition. This is impractical because no additional time is provided by statute under the APA for state agencies such as the Employment Division to file a cross petition if the employer on the 20th day files a petition for review. I might note here under ORS Chapter 19.026 on cross appeals from the circuit court, a cross appellant is given an additional period of time beyond the 30 days to file a cross appeal. No similar provision exists under the APA. And there'd be no point for the division to file a petition for judicial review unless and until the employer files one, because the division is not adversely affected by the referee's order. In other words, the referee's order is a conclusion that the employment is covered, and therefore the division doesn't really care at that point what the basis for it is. The employment is covered. It's only if the employer appeals that the employment division would be in the position of maybe wanting to argue the referee was right in his conclusion, ultimate conclusion, but for the wrong reasons. And we believe that we should be able to argue in the Court of Appeals that the referee was right, even if he's right for a reason other than the one he expressed. And Section 2 of House Bill 2218 would enable us, it would certainly clarify that it's a proper practice to make that argument. Request that you give House Bill 2218 your favorable consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Counsel?
Yes, I have a couple. In terms of 183.495, I guess on line 8, it says the court shall apportion liability. So you want the language to be mandatory rather than discretionary in terms of apportioning attorney's fees and costs.
Are you referring to the proposed amendment now to 495? You're referring to House Bill 2218, Section 1, is that correct?
Correct.
Well, what the practice of the court and all it's required to do now is simply say costs are to be paid by respondents. And it is not required to apportion the liability among the respondents. And under that circumstance, both respondents are jointly liable to pay the whole thing. And the reason we pay the whole amount is to make sure that they get paid, and then we try to seek contribution. And what this would do, if costs were $200, for example, and there were two respondents who appeared, this typically happens in employment division cases where you may have the employment division appearing and then the employer also is appearing before the Court of Appeals. If the costs were $200, the order would say that each respondent is required to pay $100 of the costs. So the employment division, we would pay the $100 for the employment division, and then the employer would be required to pay its $100.
Mr. Chairman.
Counsel.
Yeah, I'm still kind of confused on this. 495 deals with discretionary attorney's fees and costs, and now this language that you're trying to amend into this is mandatory language. Do you see an inconsistency there, or am I reading something into it?
Well, I think the way we would interpret that is where the court awards costs, and I might add that the practice of the Court of Appeals as far as costs is concerned is not to be discretionary about it. I mean, it awards costs as a matter of course. Against the agency almost in every case where the agency does appear. It's only with respect to attorney's fees where the court really gets discretionary.
Mr. Chairman?
But in the event the court were not to award costs against an agency which appeared, then the statute would have no effect.
I guess another concern I have is apportioned equally. There must be a policy basis for that. Are there cases where one respondent is more culpable or more liable than another? Is sometimes a case taken to the Court of Appeals in somebody's name or against somebody in someone else's name? We're talking about more than two agencies. We could be talking about an agency and a private party. Is that correct?
That's correct. That would be the normal circumstance.
And could it be possible that either the agency, the state agency, or the private person could be more culpable in terms of the appeal or the terms of the case?
Well, I suppose that could be the case. I think, though, that and there might be some circumstances where, one person, maybe one party, maybe ought to be required to pay more than just 50%, but I think on balance, the problem that's addressed here is present time, the Court of Appeals simply says respondents are required to pay costs. Since the amount is not that great in any particular case, we're just dealing here with costs. I'm not sure that the culpability factor is something that even ought to be considered when you're talking about $100 a piece.
Well, maybe a follow-up, if I, just for clarification, if we're talking about employment appeals board cases or employment appeals cases, and I don't pretend to have much knowledge about them, seems that the employer is a named party only, and they usually don't appear, they don't have any interest, they don't have any responsibility for the litigation, and the practical effect is you're going to send them a bill for $100, and they're going to say, why did I get this bill? I wasn't asked if I wanted to appeal it, and the person who's trying to recover the cost will go to them, and they'll tell them to, you know, hang it in your ear, basically, and I wouldn't blame them.
Representative Springer, that's, I don't think that's really the, in fact, the practice. Under the present system, the employers before the Court of Appeals appear and defend the Employment Appeals Board's orders much more frequently than does the Employment Division itself. Under those circumstances, there's only one respondent. If the employer does not appear to defend the order, then this language would not force that non-appearing employer to share the cost with the Employment Division should the Employment Division appear and defend the order. It's only if both the employer and the Employment Division appear to defend the order of the Employment Appeals Board, which is separate, as you know, from the Employment Division itself in terms of their judicial capacity. It's only in that circumstance that they'd be required to share in the cost. Does that help clarify that?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks.
Just a second. Let me just follow up. When I guess part of the problem I'm seeing is that this isn't limited to the employer.